Which homeowners have taken the biggest dive?
A closer look at underwater mortgages.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, only Tuesday, the 7th of June.
Coming up, it's been something of a habit for homeowners, and it's been harmful to the financial health of millions, those now dreaded second mortgages.
Psst. Hey, do you know this special code?
What is it?
An electronic skeleton key gets out, and it'll cost millions to replace all the digital locks.
Also, officials in Boston have got it figured out. If you want to save on energy costs, it helps to turn off the gas.
Yeah, sure. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
38%. That's the number of homeowners who took out second mortgages on their houses and are now underwater on their loans. In other words, the value of the two mortgages is higher than the value of the house. Compare that 38% with 18%, which is the figure for homeowners who are underwater and only have one mortgage. The statistics come this morning from CoreLogic, a real estate data company. Mark Fleming is CoreLogic's chief economist, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, why do you think there are so many more second mortgages that have gone bad than primary mortgages?
Well, when borrowers use second mortgages to extract equity out of their homes, they put themselves at more risk by being more levered on their homes when house prices decline. So the incidence of negative equity or being underwater in your home is higher if you'd extracted money through the form of home equity loans.
And what are the consequences for the people who are underwater?
That's a very good question. Mostly, it reduces your mobility or your ability to move. Obviously, you can't refinance or sell your house if you run into a spot of trouble with your ability to pay. So it puts you at increased risk of foreclosure and doesn't allow you to move optionally if you wanted to move into a new house or change jobs and move locations.
And I did see on the bright side, according to your data, that the overall percentage of people who are underwater on their mortgages has dropped slightly from 23% late last year to 22.7% in the beginning of this year. You think that's good news?
Yes, I do. I think any small decline at this point is good, an indication that hopefully we've weathered the worst of the storm and things will begin to get better. So I am happy to see that it's not continuing to rise, at least.
Mark Fleming, chief economist at CoreLogic, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
For another take on this topic, let's turn to Anthony Sanders, a professor of real estate finance at Virginia's George Mason University. Good morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Does this data prove the phrase that we've heard a lot, that Americans used their houses as ATMs?
Yes, it does. But we knew this was happening. We just didn't know the magnitude of it until fairly recently.
Is it worrisome? Are homeowners with second mortgages more likely to, say, walk away from their houses than those with just one mortgage?
Once you know, for example, if you put 20% down on your home, housing prices go up 10%, and you go out and get a second mortgage or a HELOC, suddenly you have an enormous amount of spending ability. You get to go out and, you know, buy that new Ford F-150 or get a big screen TV, and then suddenly housing prices fall down. You are now so over-leveraged. So that's the situation we're in today, and it is going to lead to higher default rates.
Has the situation changed? Has the number of new second mortgages dropped since the housing bubble?
Credit has tightened up very hard. You know, second mortgages are very difficult to get relative to how they were. But the problem is we still have this big backlog of first liens with second mortgages behind them that are going into default. So there still is this wave of foreclosures still to come, which is going to drive down house prices even further.
Anthony Sanders is a professor of real estate finance at George Mason University. Thanks for your insights.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
From the folks who pulled out all the stops to make all those loans comes the latest chance to influence those who regulate the financial industry. There's a political fundraiser going on tonight on Wall Street. It involves one of the writers of the new financial reform law asking for money from the very industry that's now trying to weaken that law. Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore has the story.
Every morning, a Wall Street trade group called SIFMA sends out an email with the day's news. SIFMA is the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. It represents banks and trading firms. So it's no surprise that the email is usually heavy with critical news stories about financial reform laws, like the Dodd-Frank Act. But tonight, SIFMA will be hosting a fundraising dinner for Democratic Congressman Barney Frank. Yes, he's the Frank in Dodd-Frank. SIFMA members will pay $1,000 or more for a seat at the table. The deal here isn't hard to spot. Wall Street wants to bend Frank's ear.
In politics, fundraising is very, very important to get the attention of the Congress people.
That's Lawrence Lease, a partner with law firm Duane Morris. What Wall Street wants is to influence a law that's meant to supervise it more closely. With the 2012 election on the horizon, Wall Street's trying to flex its muscle with its perceived adversaries. Frank's the ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee, but he's by no means alone. Politicians from President Obama on down are angling to fill up their campaign coffers. Obama just held fundraisers for prominent Wall Street executives who could pay $35,000 or more for a seat.
One of the number one skills of a congressman or a senator is they know how to count. They know how to count votes, and they know where their fundraising comes from.
Not that that will guarantee results. Just as an interest group will give to both parties, a politician will accept from all sides. Here's Jerry Goldfeder. He's an election lawyer with Strzok & Strzok & Lavon.
They may expect something in return, but it is rare that a congressman or presidential candidate can be bought.
SIFMA declined to comment on the Manhattan dinner. Barney Frank's spokesman told us, if Wall Street is trying to buy influence with him, it has been a dramatic failure. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
After a string of recent cyber attacks on the likes of Sony and Google, there's some corporate fallout this morning. A data storage company called EMC is offering to replace millions of electronic keys, known as secure IDs, after a breach at defense contractor Lockheed Martin last month.
Yeah, it turns out those secure IDs weren't so secure after all. Mm. Marketplace's Amy Scott joins us now with more on this story. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Amy, I don't use one of these secure IDs, but I've seen them. What are they exactly?
Well, they're mostly used by millions of government and corporate workers to log onto their computers or software. And it can be a smart card or a key fob like you might use to unlock your car. And they have a little screen that flashes a series of numbers that you enter as a way of proving you are who you say you are.
So they're supposed to be really secure. What went wrong here?
Well, all we know is that in March, data was stolen from the division of EMC that makes the keys, RSA Security, and that was used to hack into the network at Lockheed Martin last month. RSA called it a very sophisticated attack. I spoke earlier with Roger Kay of Endpoint Technologies Associates, a market research firm, and he says what's different about this breach than some of the others we've been seeing lately is that it's a security company.
What we do know about this, which is really bad news, is that people who are in the security business have been unable to keep their system from a breach, which says if they're not safe, then who is?
And what's also scary is that the hackers appear to be targeting defense contractors. Lockheed says it stopped the attack, but, it may not be the only company caught up in this.
Marketplace's Amy Scott. Thanks, Amy.
You're welcome.
NBC Universal is buying the rest of the Universal Orlando theme park from the private equity firm Blackstone for $1 billion. Blackstone has owned a 50% stake in Universal Studios and Islands of Adventure for the last 11 years.
And I'd like to go to a theme park today, Bob, but I'm going to go to sleep instead. Yeah. For more business news and the numbers from Wall Street, you can head to our website, marketplace.org.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. The price of a barrel of crude was trading around $100 in New York this morning. High oil prices have made gas more expensive, so consumers have less money to spend on other things. Well, tomorrow, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, is meeting in Vienna to consider an urgent request to crank up production so prices can come down. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale says, don't get your hopes up.
Oil is dear for a whole bunch of reasons. Civil war in Libya, demand from booming emerging markets, and a weak dollar. Rushir Kadakia at Cambridge Energy Research Associates says there's not much oil exporters can do about it.
We are driving the oil market right now on a lot of components that OPEC is not able to control.
Still, oil importers say if OPEC would raise its production targets, prices would fall, and that would help lagging economies like the U.S. and Europe recover. Oil analyst Peter Butel at Cameron Hanover says only Saudi Arabia has any excess capacity right now.
The Saudis want to go ahead and have a higher quota because that will officially give them a higher proportion of the market share. The Iranians are dead set against it because they can't increase the amount that they produce.
But Butel says OPEC is already exceeding its production quotas. Raising them would just make it official and wouldn't bring oil prices down. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis now from Julie Neiman. She's an analyst with Smith Moore & Company, and she joins us from St. Louis, as she does every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, Julie, is an increase in production by OPEC really the answer to our oil price problems?
Well, everybody's looking ahead to the second half of the year, not to supply and demand right now, because right now we still have plenty of supplies and demand is still fairly weak. As far as OPEC increasing their production, it would basically put enough into the supply system to keep it from going over $100 a barrel. They're very afraid that keeping it over $100 a barrel will just kill total global demand for it.
Julie, a lot of people have mentioned speculators as one of the reasons why oil has stayed so high. Is that your view?
Absolutely true. You know, it's an alternative currency, kind of like black gold. The debt limit is likely to pass, so the dollar is going to go down and oil and gold will go up. So you're looking at an alternative currency here. And a lot of the trading is in paper barrels, commodity funds, exchange-traded funds and derivatives. That's far in excess of what the physical supply is.
And do you think that the economy can get going again if oil prices remain as they are now or go even higher?
Well, oil is really a tax. It can slow growth, but it doesn't kill it. The killers in the United States are jobs and housing, and those are the biggest thing hits to consumer spending. So oil just adds fuel to the problem. It really isn't the killer for the economy.
What's gas price look like where you are, Julie?
Right now, we're down to a very modest $3.59.
That does sound like a deal. Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Agriculture ministers from across Europe are holding an urgent meeting today, and the European Union's health chief is warning Germany against making premature conclusions about the source of contaminated food that's already killed 22 people and cost farmers billions in exports. It's reminiscent of the big E. coli scare here in the U.S. a couple of years ago, when federal regulators struggled for months to pinpoint the source. The BBC's Tristana Moore is joining us now from Berlin. Greetings.
Hello.
First, they thought it was Spanish cucumbers, then German sprouts, both of which have turned out to be wrong. Where are they looking next?
Well, I think they're still looking at sprouts, really, because over the weekend, the German authorities pointed the finger of blame at bean sprouts. Initial tests suggested that these locally grown bean sprouts were the likely source of the bacterial outbreak, which has killed so far 22 people in Germany and infected hundreds more. And the sprouts haven't been given the all clear yet.
Now, I saw a report that Spanish produce growers lost an estimated $600 million in exports last week after they got the initial erroneous blame for this. Why does it seem to be so hard to figure out where this food contamination is coming from?
Dr. John Cowden is a consultant for health protection in Scotland, where they also had an E. coli outbreak a couple of years ago. And he says that pinning down just one source can be incredibly difficult.
When you speak to a large number of the cases, you may find that actually they don't have anything in common. Some may have eaten bean sprouts, some may have eaten tomatoes, some may have eaten lettuce, some may have contracted the disease from other people in the family or indeed from people that they don't even know are ill.
So that's why experts are working round the clock here in Germany to try to track down the source of this outbreak.
The BBC's Tristana Moore is in Berlin. Thanks for updating us.
Thank you.
There are bigger catastrophes to worry about in Europe, Bob. There's a man in the UK named Mark Wilkinson who took out his new boat, which is called Titanic 2, for its maiden voyage.
Titanic 2.
And wouldn't you know it, the boat sank.
No.
It did. Wilkinson made it out okay, though he says he's a little annoyed with all the people who are asking him if he hit an iceberg. One eyewitness to the sinking, though, says Titanic 2 was so small that an ice cube probably would have sunk it.
When the Daily Deal site Groupon goes public soon, its founders are likely to become very rich. And here's why that's causing excitement in Chicago. Local startups are hoping some of that money will trickle back down to them. From the Windy City, here's WBEZ's Ashley Gross.
Tech entrepreneur Ashish Rangnekar unlocks a door in Groupon's sprawling headquarters in downtown Chicago. He's leading me to the office of Watermelon Express, his test prep software company.
And then we are here.
In this building, Watermelon Express is like a tiny barnacle stuck to the side of the Groupon battleship. It's an example of how Groupon is trying to help small companies like this one get their legs.
I would not want to be in any other city but Chicago right now.
Last year, Rangnekar met Groupon's founders, Eric Lefkowski and Brad Keywell. They liked his idea so much, they decided to invest in it and give him office space. Rangnekar was one of 10 local entrepreneurs the Groupon founders backed with their $100 million venture capital fund, Lightbank. Groupon's IPO will almost certainly turn Lefkowski, Keywell, and other Groupon executives into billionaires, and people in Chicago hope they'll plow even more money into local startups. That could help Chicago become less of a flyover city when it comes to tech. The Midwest has long trailed Silicon Valley, New York, and New England in venture capital deals. Steve Kaplan teaches entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business.
We really haven't had a big winner where the winner has had people who are, you know, technology savvy who want to put money back in. So it's a big deal.
But despite all the excitement, few people expect Chicago to edge out Silicon Valley anytime soon. Bump Technologies makes apps for smartphones and got its start in Chicago. But Chief Executive David Lieb says the company concluded there weren't enough engineers and software developers here. So they set up headquarters in Mountain View, California.
For us, you know, we knew we had to hire a bunch of people. And being here in the Valley is really where all that technical talent is.
But Chicagoans are hoping Groupon's success will change that and seed the growth of what some here are calling Silicon Prairie. In Chicago, I'm Ashley Gross for Marketplace.
There's a report out this morning from Consumer Reports that finds hospital infections are a big problem where you'd least expect them. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
We're so brand-obsessed in this country. We assume that prestigious teaching hospitals have lower infection rates than community hospitals. Wrong. Dr. John Santa heads the Consumer Reports Health Ratings Center. He says doctors in the big hospitals are under so much pressure, they may skip the sterile gowns and hand washing that can prevent infections.
Other priorities are competing with this one. And our point is, this one should be more important.
What to do? Ask doctors and nurses to wash their hands before they examine you. That can be hard. I get tongue-tied around doctors, even though I talk for a living. Santa says be polite but firm.
We have to figure out how to get on a more equal plane with our physicians and hospitals and be comfortable speaking up.
Here's more incentive. Up to a quarter of patients who get infections in their bloodstreams die. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And finally, the city of Boston, Jeremy. You know a little bit about Boston,
sure.
Right?
Uh-huh. I used to live there. I love Boston.
Well, it prides itself on the vintage gas lamps that started adorning its winding streets back in the early 1800s. Apparently, it's taken all this time for technology to catch up with itself, though. Seems Boston officials have just figured out that they can save around $140,000 a year in energy costs by not keeping the lanterns burning all day long.
They just figured that out.
So they're going to install automatic igniters. They'll spark the gas lamps to life just at nightfall.
Uh-huh.
And in keeping with the conservation theme, those triggering devices are even solar-powered.
Wow. Smart idea. So they're really finally moving into the 21st century.
Right. Didn't Paul Revere use a solar power?
No comment, Bob. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. In for Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.